Show is sponsored in part by Horton's Funeral Service, Dr. Edward T. Buford, and the Athletic Republic Capital Region, and as always, powered by the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com, and the guy who makes this show possible, my main man, my producer, out of Motown, he is Rick Hampton Sr. Well, folks, in the Coach's Corner, this afternoon, without further ado, we are going to bring one of the all-time great legends in the D.C. area in terms of basketball, the pride of McFaulin Junior High School at Petworth Playground, Mackin High School, Notre Dame, and the NBA. He is Donald Duck Williams. Hey, Duck, good afternoon.
Yeah.
It's such an honor to have you in the Coach's Corner. How are you?
I'm fine. Glad to be with you.
Well, Doc, let's get started. I want to talk about a guy who I know you've watched playing growing up in the D.C. area, following basketball at the NBA level when you were in middle school and high school. And I want to get your reflections on the passing of the great Wes Unseld.
Well, you know, I'm watching Wes Unseld in my younger days, going over to Baltimore to watch the Bullets play and whatever. You know, I always looked at Wes Unseld as the rock of the Washington Bullets. You know, he always was a character guy as far as, you know, watching from afar and then getting to play against him. Just to see the kind of leader that he was for the Washington Bullets, you know, may he rest in peace. It's just an honor to for me to be on the floor with the Wes Unseld, a person that I looked up to when I was growing up, because you know the Washington Bullets was the thing in the Washington D.C. area as far as basketball and professional basketball.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you use the term character guy, and I love that term. But for some of our listeners, maybe some of the younger listeners who that term isn't as used as much as in the old days, explain what you mean by he or she were a character person.
A person, to me, a person that you could really, you know, depend on, a guy that shows leadership and showed respect to all the other players on the team, because you know, knowing that when you have a team and you always have, you know, the superstar on the team, or you know, a guy who might get in line, get out of line, but you got a player who can pull those guys in, and guys can look up to and say, hey, show them the right way to do things, and that's the kind of character guy that you need on a team to be successful.
And also, Wes Unseld was the type of player that he really didn't care about stats.
The
most important stat that he cared about was that W. And if
that's
it meant making that perfect outlet pass or setting that pick or getting on the floor for a loose ball, he would do it, the little things that really don't show up that large in the stat column, but boy, it contributes greatly to a victory.
No doubt, no doubt at all. And if you look at all the teams, you know, from college to the NBA, there's always that guy who holds the team together. He might not get all the headlines, but it's just like you, if you're having a chain, if one link is missing,
yeah,
things doesn't run as smoothly.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, let's talk about Donald Duck Williams. I started hearing about you at a very early age, you know, back in the, and I don't know whether things are like that today in the 2020, but in the 70s, when you were good, you built your reputation at an early age, some cases 10 and under, certainly by 14 and under. And at a very early age, around 10, 12 and under, I started hearing about this kid in the Petworth area that could really, really play. And when I saw you, the first time I saw you, I think it was the old ghetto tournament for some of our listeners. That was the premier tournament that was held at Lincoln Junior High School during the Easter season. And you played. The thing that impressed me so much about you, Duck, not necessarily just your skill set, but your poise. And when I saw you, I said, now this 12-year-old kid plays like he's 16. Talk about the foundation of that. And when I got to find out who you were, and I said, oh, now I know. I know his older brothers. But talk about the foundation.
For you to say that, I have to give a lot of that credit, you know, to my mom, to my brothers, because, you know, I was the youngest of eight brothers. And to be able to, you know, go to the basketball court and watch them at the early age, I wasn't big enough to play, but they took me along with them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I always looked up to them. You know, they showed me the way and the path, and you know, I just picked up on it, and I tried to, you know, perfected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you did that. What were some of the things that you would do? I remember reading about that you would watch a game on TV, and then afterwards you would go down in the basement and turn the lights out and practice on your dribbling and imitate some of the players. A true story?
You're going back in old times with that. Exactly correct. You know, a lot of times, you know, I was an avid fan of watching basketball, and especially watching the NBA. You know, at that time, you know, you didn't get a lot of games on TV. You might got the main game on CBS or something like that. And, you know, I would watch a game, watching the Jerry West and the Oscar Robertson, the Dave Beans. And, you know, after the game was over with, I would go down the basement and set the lights out just to try to perfect my dribbling skills. Seemed like it worked out, though.
Oh, it really worked out. And again, growing up in D.C. and Baltimore and Philadelphia, all your major cities in the 70s and 80s and the 60s, you improved your game. Your laboratory was not a gym per se, but it was the playground. And you would go to different playgrounds, but everybody had their home. Now, I remember your home court was Petworth. Is that right?
Petworth, that's correct. Well, I really started at a young age playing at Stead Playground at 16th and Houston.
That's right.
Because I'd gone to Sumner Elementary, and we lived in that area, and to constantly go down to Stead Playground. But I think I had most of my proving grounds at Petworth Elementary and Petworth Playground.
And of course, junior high school basketball, man, it was so organized, and everyone had one or two great players. You, of course, played at McFarland. But talk about junior high schools. And, Duck, I can remember, our listeners can relate to this, I can remember going to the junior high school playoff games with 2,000, 3,000 people in the stands.
Hey, that was a great player during the high school teams. You know, I think back when you had the Rabot Junior High with the Wilson brothers. You had Bertie Backus with Agent Dantley and Eugene Robinson.
That's right.
You had Lincoln Junior High with Arthur Daniels, along Angelo Council.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those teams. Now that team, that Lincoln team, you know, I was a lot smaller at that time. I hadn't reached my growth spurt. But those teams looked like giant teams.
Yeah.
With Arthur Daniels and Angelo Council, and had a lot of big guys. So, you know, it was really competitive.
Now,
and then you go over and talk about
it. Now I'm going to say this, and this was a few years after you, a couple of years maybe, but the best junior high school team I ever witnessed was that team, I think it was at Evans, with Craig Shelton, James Ratcliffe, Rodney Wright, and a couple others.
Okay, now they also had a heck of a team before that crew, which if you remember, with the Carol Holmes and Morris Tyler crew.
That
was a hell of a team, too.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Oh, boy, I knew this would be a good one. In the coach's corner, I've got the legendary Donald Duck Williams aboard. And, Duck, as I said, you coming out of rec ball and junior high school ball, you'd built up a reputation. Talk about how you landed at Mackin.
Well, you know, when I graduated from McFarland, my coach, Arthur Linda, had got the job at Roosevelt. Now, I had three schools that I was thinking about going to. If I went to the Inner High, I was going to Roosevelt. If I went to the Catholic League, I talked to Morgan Wooten and I talked to Harry Rett. And those were the three choices. And I had a talk with Harry Rett. And, you know, going in there as a sophomore, you know, it basically was a new turnover there, because they had just moved from the old Mackin up to the new Mackin.
That's right.
And had a lot of new players there. You know,
yeah.
I think the players that was still there was, you know, you had Fred Bailey, you had Larry Herring.
That's
who
right.
Came up. You know, but with myself, David Reavers, Herring, you know, then we had Joe Johanna. So, you know, it was a lot of good players coming through Mackin at that time. And, of course, you know, there were great teams like the Dantley DeMatha teams, and with the Skip McDaniels, Art Daniels,
Eddie
Jordan,
with
that team. So, you know, going to Mackin, you know, you had a good crew there, so it was time to really, you know, compete. Everybody had a crew that was capable of competing and possibly winning a Catholic League. So, you know, things tend to work out by, you know, going over to Mackin and teaming up with those guys. And,
yeah. Yeah. Duck Williams is at the coach's corner, and, Duck, you mentioned a player. And he doesn't get mentioned as much as he should, because he only played 1 year at Mackin. But let's talk about David Reavers, Shake and Bake Revo. This guy, look, Archie Clark was the first to do the crossover. But I got to tell you, nobody, Archie, Allen Iverson, or anyone, could cross over like Revo. David Reavers.
No one can do it like Reavers. Reavers had that killer crossover butch, and you knew it was coming, but you couldn't stop it.
No, you couldn't stop it. You definitely could not stop it. And at 6'5", back in 1972, that was a huge point guard. A huge point guard, because Reavers played the point and you played the two.
Right. And just think of it, you talk about point guards, you talk about guards, and, I'm thinking about all the guards that we had at Mackin, or the guards, that come out of Mackin. And to think of it, Keith Herron played center for us.
Yes,
at Mackin. But Keith Herron had guard skills, going to Villanova and playing the NBA. Keith
great
was
player.
A guard.
Great, great, great player. You mentioned the tradition, and I've had Coach Bob Wade and Muggsy Bogues from Dunbar, Baltimore on recently. I just had Gerard Mustar from DeMatha on. So we talked about Poet Pride for Dunbar. We talked about the Stag Pride. Now let's talk about something that's near and dear to my heart, Mackin Pride and the tradition. There's no school in this D.C. area, and I would say in the country, that have produced better guards throughout than Mackin. You start with Ray Savoy, a Bill Butler, a Tom Little, Austin Carr, then a Duck Williams, a David Rivas, a JoJo Hunter, a Kenny Payne, a Johnny Dawkins, and those are the guards.
Yeah,
Dominique Presley.
What about Dominique Presley and George Gibbs? Those guys.
Absolutely, no question, my man. But talk about that tradition. Were you aware of the Mackin tradition when you selected it as a sophomore?
Well, when I selected, I was aware of the Austin Carr, and I got to meet Mr. Butler, and I've heard a lot of Tom Little. So, I was aware more so of Austin Carr and Tom Little, but I got to know even more about Mr. Butler.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yeah. Duck Williams in the coach's corner. And, Duck, I can remember that 73 season where you had a DeMatha team that would have probably been number one in the country had they not had that loss to Dunbar, and Dunbar won it. I mean, Skip Wise and Larry Gibson and my good friend Tim Green, they had the game of their lives, and they won it legitimately. But that was the only loss that DeMatha had. But you guys took them in overtime. Carroll took them in overtime. St. John's, the night before, took them in two overtimes, possibly three. That 73 season with those four top teams, Carroll, Mackin, DeMatha, and St. John's, it was a coin flip.
Oh, no doubt. You think about all those players on those teams, played with each other or against each other on the playgrounds, or played with each other in the United States youth games back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So, we all competed against each other. So when we went to play against each other, it was a bar fight.
That's right. The other thing, going back to your family structure, the one thing that I knew about the Williams family, you guys and your brothers were tremendous athletes, but you guys were also honor roll students. Talk about how you were able at Mackin to be a high school All-American, but also be an honor roll student as well.
Well, I took pride in that. And my mom and my brothers, they instilled this, if you're trying to get to the next level, you can be a hell of a basketball player, but you got to have some smarts too.
Mm-hmm.
To get a scholarship is very important to make sure, you have your academics down, because, at some point in time, the air is going to come out of that basketball, but life goes on. So you have to have something, to fall back on
or
be successful in this world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We talked about the teams But, Duck, if you recall, were there any one or two players that you and they were always big rival, that you enjoyed going against them and vice versa?
Well, you know, I enjoy competing against all the top guys and players in D.C. area. I mean, it wasn't no one particular guy, because if you looked at most teams, every team had one or two players that were hell of a basketball player.
Right.
But if you're looking at just the say in the Catholic League, you know, Skip McDaniels and Eddie Jordan, that was a test every time we played, because they both were hell of a basketball players. Then you look at the DeMathis, you know, you had the Dantley, and even though he wasn't a guard, but you know, you had to compete against the, you know, the Kenny Roys and the Billy Langos.
Yeah,
it was competitive all around, but it wasn't any particular player. It was just that, you know, most of those teams was talented basketball teams. You know, I hate to just include just to say one, because there were so many teams that had very good basketball players on there, and you had to be ready, you know, to compete when you played against those guys, because they were coming at you.
And speaking of coming at you, one thing I remember as a very young coach watching Mac in practice, you guys, that 73 season and the 74 season, you guys had some tremendous competitive practices. You know, and I'm watching you guys go against each other and the second team and people getting on the floor and you never missing. I mean, the practices were more difficult in most cases than the games.
No doubt. You know, I think that's one of the things that made all the players on our team really competitive, because, you know, when you went out on that floor, each guy was competing hard, playing hard, and I think that's what led to all the guys. There were eight guys on our team that got Division I scholarships.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that competing and practice against the other players who were Division I players, you know, it all benefited all of us, because we were playing against top-level players every day in practice.
And
as one more player I like to mention, it might have been nine Division I players, because Gerald Purnell.
Yes.
Bucknell.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a Division I player.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we had a crew of players. I don't know if a lot of teams can say that they played with, at one time, eight players or nine players that was on that team went to Division I schools.
That's right.
When you talked about the Heron brothers of Villanova, Joe Johannes at Maryland, talk about David Revis at Georgia, Larry Long at Georgetown. Now, we're talking about top programs.
Yeah, yeah. So I think
those practices made it very, very competitive and helpful to all the players on our team.
Duck Williams is in the coach's corner. Donald Duck Williams, Mackin High School, Notre Dame, NBA. And Duck, you were one of the top players in the country. You go to Howard Garfinkel's camp and he falls in love with you, rightfully so. You get the big write-ups, and coming in your senior year, you literally have a target on your back, but you hold true to your billing that year. Talk about your off-season routine to improve from one year to the next.
Well, basically, you know, it just comes from, you know, like hard work in the summertime, you're playing. I tell you a story, you know.
Sure.
With Agent Dantley and I, we used to go over to Mackin and work out at Mackin. And we used to get up in the morning and we'd do our work lift, weightlifting, running, and so forth. We'd go down to Haynes Point and run Haynes Point. You know, all this, I think basketball players get better when they improve their game. And relentless workout in the summertime and consistently shooting the basketball, working on your game, you know, makes you a better basketball player. And that's something that I always pride on. I think, you know, you look back at today's game, like you say, we wasn't always in the gym. We spent a lot of this time out on the asphalt, on the playground.
That's right.
And we lived on the playgrounds. You know, I talk about to young guys now. I say, you know, I ride around the city and I look at the basketball courts and they're empty.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, back in the 70s, you go to basketball courts, you didn't get there early in the morning to work on your game. You didn't play.
That's right.
They're packed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's something that, you know, I always did because I wanted to be, you know, a better basketball player and perfect my game is get up in the summertime and work out, and whether it's running, whether it's lifting weights, or, you know, playing one-on-one full court in the hot sun.
Mm-hmm.
But those things paid off.
Yeah. I want to go back to the point because I want people to understand that when you get a lot of publicity, it'll either make you or break you. And I recall coming out, going into your senior year, you were one of the top players in the country, as I stated. Had a big picture, and at that time, the Bible of basketball was Street and Smith.
Right.
And I open up the Street and Smith, and I see Duck Williams. Now, a lot of people, as I said, you had the bullseye on your back. A lot of people would have the gunslinger mentality. Well, look, we're going to play Mac, and I'm going against Duck. I'm going to prove I'm better. All right. But you used it as motivation because you said, hey, I got this publicity, so now I got to work harder so I can live up to it because I know people coming at me. Talk about that again.
No doubt. Like I say, once you get recognized as a basketball player, and quite frankly, all players think highly of themselves as basketball players. And when you read or see articles about a certain player, you know that other player's mentality say, I don't think he is as good as they say he is. So they're coming at him. So you have to be prepared and ready for whatever's coming towards you, because, you know, I knew there was a lot of players who was like, well, I'm going to see how good he is or whatever. I used to get the stories where we would play a game and they said, oh, you the All-American. Huh? I'm going to show you or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, I had the mentality, okay, bring it on. I'll show you.
That's right. Yeah, I loved it. And once again, you have the option of a lot of colleges/universities to attend. You select Notre Dame. I know one of the, not all, but I'm familiar with one of the factors or influences. Let's talk about somebody that was very, very dear to me as a graduate of Mackin in 1969 and very dear to you as a graduate of Mackin in 1974, and that's Brother Ralph Jaworski. Talk
right.
About Brother Ralph.
Brother Ralph, he was a great principal at the time. You know, Brother Ralph, he pulled me into the office one day, and we was talking, and he said, Duck, he said, the one thing I want you to do is I want you to go to Notre Dame. A school that had a good academic program, basketball on the rise. Austin Carr was a former Mackin graduate and went there and was very successful there. And, you know, talking with Brother Ralph and looking at Notre Dame in itself, it was just after visiting it, it was just a place that I felt that I could be successful at. And Brother Ralph was a big part of that because of the leadership he showed at Mackin High School to all the students there.
Talk about your short list. Obviously, you selected Notre Dame, but what were some of the other programs that were on that short list? Was it North Carolina or North Carolina State or University of Maryland or UCLA on your short list?
Well, schools that the way I had looked at it was Notre Dame. If I'd have stayed in the area, it would have been the University of Maryland. If I'd have went down south, it would have been North Carolina, you know, because I think the top assistant at that time was Eddie Fogler.
Yes.
And, you know, he made frequent visits up to Mackin High School. And, of course, you know, being from the D.C. area, Lefty Giselle, who I thought was one of the best recruiters in the area. That would have been my choice about a state home.
Mm-hmm. Talk about just a little bit about Lefty. I had Coach Giselle on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he always gets a little offensive when people call him a great recruiter, and he'll say, "Yeah, but Dean got more players than I." Blah blah blah, and I find that interesting.
Right.
But share with us maybe. Excuse me, Doug. Share with us maybe a recruiting story that you recall with Coach Giselle. I mean, he could speak the language, man.
Oh, no doubt. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, Coach Giselle. You know, he was a hell of a coach at Maryland too.
That's right.
And that's the to say that as far as a recruiter, when you look at the talent that he brought
right.
in Maryland, that tells you, you know, he was a great recruiter. But, you know, going back, one of the stories, it was a game we was going to play. I think we were going to play DeMatha. And I had sprained my ankle. That Friday, we was gonna play him that Saturday or that Sunday at St. John's,
mm-hmm.
and I sprained my ankle that Friday, and you know I had been working on my ankle all Saturday and so forth, and I saw one of the trainers at Maryland trying to get me right for
mm-hmm.
game, and. You know, just knowing that, you know, that possibly could be one of the schools that I was going to, you know, and Coach Giselle was, you know, being the recruiter he was, trying to help get me together, man. You know, I'll never forget that week there.
Yeah. And you go to Notre Dame and you make a transition, but the transition initially wasn't as smooth as you would have liked it to have been. I'm looking at a story where it was written by Thomas Boswell, famous sports writer,
uh-huh.
columnist, Washington Post, and a paragraph, Williams arrived from Mackin with a lean bill, and here's a quote, and was pushed around. And here's a quote, sometimes things weren't going my way, and coach would say, Duck, your time will come. And then you continue to say, I'm thankful my parents raised me right, or maybe I would have quit. You have to wonder, between the ball and the books, will I be able to make it? Expound on that.
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, going to a school like Notre Dame, great academic school, you have to, you know, prepare yourself. And just going to college, period, as an athlete, you know, you have to, a lot of the guys that are there are bigger and stronger once you get there. And I realized once I got there that, you know, I had to work on my game, get in the weight room to get stronger, and which I did. And once I did that, you know, things started to turn around. You know, I guess it's just like guys going from college to the NBA. Guys are bigger, faster, stronger. So now you see most of the guys, they're in the weight room all the time, strength and condition, being ready. And that's, to me, you know, that was one of the transitions for me going when I went from high school to college, getting bigger, getting stronger, being able to take the poundings, the pushing around and so forth. And once that all kicked in, it was game on.
That's right. It was just like being at Petworth Playground. And, you know, we talked about the tradition of Mackin and great guards. But you go to Notre Dame, and Notre Dame has a tradition of basketball players from D.C., starting with the great late Bob Whitmore. And then from Bob Whitmore,
right,
Alston Carr, as you mentioned, Sid Catlett, Collis Jones, Adrian Dantley, and now Duck Williams. Talk about that unique pipeline from Washington, D.C. to South Bend, Indiana.
Well, you know, it was a hell of a pipeline. When you talk about the late Bob Whitmore, rest his soul.
Yeah.
Sid Catlett, Alston Carr, Collis Jones. Don't forget the Collis Jones. And, of course, you know, Aiden Dantley and myself, Trey Jackson, Tom Sloovy.
That's right.
But, you know, that
Cecil
that
Rucker
pipeline
later on.
Cecil Rucker. You know, Tracy Jackson, that whole crew. But, you know, I like to say something about one gentleman who was passed on, who was very influential in getting us to Notre Dame, and that was a gentleman by the name of Franny Collins,
mm-hmm,
you know, who really kept an eye on all the players and communicated with all the players and was very helpful,
mm-hmm,
you know, with all the players. You know, if you were to talk to any of the players, you know, you won't mention a Notre Dame pipeline without mentioning Franny Collins.
Mm-hmm. And what was it like playing basketball at a school which was known for football? And, yeah, I mean, what was that like? So, for example, let's say if you go to a Marquette, or at the time you go to North Carolina or Maryland, those were basketball schools first, St. John's,
right,
Georgetown.
Right.
But when you go to a Texas, a Notre Dame, those are football schools with really good basketball programs. What was that like?
Well, to me, I always looked at when you look at the era of the Alston Carr, Coach Johnny D,
mm-hmm,
Bob Whitmore, and that crew, and then you go on to John Shumate and Dantley and myself. I always looked at it as though, when the football team, we all, it was always the same, if the football team, if they lost one game, then it was game on, because football was always, if you lose one game, national championship normally is out.
Mm-hmm.
And Notre Dame, they didn't play to have this stuff. You know, we have a so-so season. It was mostly every year it was championship or bust. And once the game was lost at Notre Dame, you know, we would always say that, hey, it's our time. It's our show now. You know. And when Digger came on, and with the crew that he had brought in from the Shoemates, the Brokaws, Danley, and the White Clays, the Ray Martins, with that crew, and after the winning, you know, the 88-game winning streak,
mm-hmm.
and putting Notre Dame really on the map as a powerhouse basketball team, things tend begin to change, especially in the 70s, and then when Coach Phelps came on, mm-hmm. you know, we were always in the top 10 or the top 7 in basketball, even in number 1 for a number of years, weeks. So, you know, that program really just, to me, just went to the top during the 70s when all those guys from the D.C. pipeline that started coming to Notre Dame, and things just changed. And people looked at Notre Dame not just a football school at that time. You know, the basketball was on the rise. You know, every year you're playing at UCLA, the Marquette, the Kentucky, and you're on national TV and you're beating those teams. So, a lot of things changed then.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you alluded to the fact that Adrian and Shoemate and those guys, they snapped the UCLA streak, correct?
Correct.
But then let's talk about when you are the leader of the team. AD now is in the NBA doing his thing. And you
right.
guys snap a streak. You, and I'm not going to necessarily call it an upset, but you snapped the winning streak of San Francisco with Bill Cartwright and that crew.
Yeah, they,
and I remember watching it with great pride and saying, look at my boy from Mackin, Duck Williams. Talk about that game.
Yeah, that game, San Francisco came in running 29-0. They had a pro squad.
Yeah, they did.
if you go down the line with the Bill Cartwright and the James Hardy, who I was fortunate enough to play with in the NBA, Chubby Cox, which Kobe Bryant's uncle, they had a Winford Bourne's. They had a hell of a team, and I always call it that team approaching. That starting five all played in the NBA, so. You know, and they was 29-0, and they came in Notre Dame riding high. But they were always saying, when you come into Notre Dame, number one, you better watch out.
That's right. That's right. And the thing that I, as well as others in the D.C. area, took great pride, and not just you guys snapping streaks, but it was always the D.C. guy leading the way.
Yeah, you
whether
know,
it was Austin or Adrian or Duck.
And that, you know, that San Francisco game, you know, one move that Digger decided to make in the second half, he decided to, he said, we're going to go in a four-corner offense, and we're going to spread it out, and we're going to put Duck in the middle, and he was like, Duck, do your thing. And you know, I felt that, you know, the guys that was guarding me, Winford Boyd, the Chubby Cox, I thought I had a quicker step that I could get by them.
Yeah.
And it worked out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No question. Talk about one of your teammates. And this guy, especially with the showing of The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan documentary. But this tough guy, this enforcer, Bill Laimbeer, was one of your guys. He was one of your teammates. Talk about Laimbeer. I mean, was he really that tough, or did he develop into it? Because I remember him being a good player, but a player who could step outside, hit the shot, and set a good pick.
Well, you know, I loved Olambeer because he was, like you say, he set a good pick. I benefit from a lot of those picks that Olambeer set in school. And he basically played the same way in college.
Yeah,
he would set the nasty picks. He would give the hard fouls. And he always, when we had drills at school, he always wanted to shoot with the guard. We would have shooting drills, and we would stick around after practice or whatever. Lambeer would always be out shooting with the guard. So when he went into the NBA and was making that shot, I would tell people, I said, look, I've seen that shot. He did that in college. He stepped out and shot that shot. He always wanted to shoot in drills with the guard.
Let's go back and talk about a guy who we both have so much respect for. And he was one of my very first guests. I love the guy, my favorite player. But you were his teammate. You worked out with him. Share with our listeners, because this question has been asked so many times. I know the answer. You have even a better answer. What made Adrian Dantley such a great basketball player? Because with the naked eye, for people who really don't know the game, they look at him and said, well, he's not that tall, he's not that athletic, you know, he doesn't jump that well, he's not this, he's not that, but what he is a Hall of Famer and a scoring machine. What made AD so special from your perspective?
Well, from my perspective, AD's work ethic, you know. AD worked it religiously on his game. You know, he was a fundamental player, and you know, it was just that, you know, he was the type of guy who took pride in his game and a guy that wanted to be great. And by working out with AD, I learned a lot as far as, you know, what it took, you know, to be a good basketball player.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, playing against Adrian in high school and watching how he worked. Well, let's go back. You know,
okay.
I played against Adrian when he was at Bernie Backus, just when
right.
he was a little bigger, a little chubbier.
Mm-hmm.
But he still had the same fundamentals, you know, head fake. You know, if you watch Adrian over the years, he would do that same move, bend, head fake. He would get you every time.
Yeah.
Guys would constantly foul him. And he would go to the free throw line and knock down the free throws. But overall, he was a good guy, and he was a
yes.
hard worker. And,
yes,
you know,
yes.
He perfected his game by, you know, being a solid, fundamental player, and he's a good guy.
Oh, no question about that. Great guy. One of my all-time favorites. And then you make another transition in the great game of basketball, this time from Notre Dame to the NBA, and talk about the preparations for Duck Williams to be an NBA player now.
Well, I think when you know, even talking about Adrian, you know, him showing me a lot of the ins and out about the NBA and, you know, the work ethic that you have to have and, you know, the workouts that we did during the summertime helped me so greatly as far as, you know, the weightlifting, the running, you know, the running the Haynes point, and being prepared when I got to the next level. It was amazing, you know, to go to Utah and be on a team or on the floor in the starting lineup with three Hall of Famers. Pete Maravich, Adrian Dantley, and Bernard King.
Wow.
You know. So, you know, to be able to play with those guys and learn from those guys and learn from a guy like, you know, Pete Maravich and Bernard, you know, it was just an honor just to be on the floor to play with those guys.
Mm-hmm. Talk about Pete Maravich, Pistol Pete Maravich, because if you're young and you didn't get a chance to see Pistol Pete play, you missed something. And when I look at a carry today, and people say, well, we've never seen anything like it. And I say, yes, we have. Pete Maravich. Now, Carey is a great player, but Pete Maravich had the range, he had the accuracy, and he had that green light, shoot him until I can't shoot anymore mentality. Talk about Pistol Pete.
Well, you know, me being a rookie, and Pete sort of took me under his wings, showing me the ropes. I'd never seen a guy, you know, at 6'6". People don't realize how tall Pete was. A 6'6 guard,
mm-hmm,
who could do it all.
Yeah.
He just had a bag of tricks in his arsenal that was, you know, just tough to guard.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's tough making the NBA. It was even tougher then because you had fewer teams, so that meant fewer job opportunities.
That's true.
But Duck, I've always said that in order to make the NBA, you have to do at least one thing exceptionally well. Not just good or very good, but you have to do at least one thing exceptionally well. Talk about, besides being at the right place in the right time, what are some of the skill sets that's needed to play in the NBA?
Well, you know, if you're going from position to position, you know, if you're a big guy, you got to have skills to, you know, to rebound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, small forwards, you got to be able to have the skills to shoot the ball from the outside, but also, you know, create for others. You know, a point guard. You have to be able to set up your teammates, get the ball to the right people at the right time. You know, if you might not be the best shooter, but you know how to orchestrate and get the ball to the people who put them in the position to score. Shooting guard, you know, you got to be able to shoot the basketball. Especially, you know, if you're in today's game, you know, you can make a living in the NBA just being a special, just shooting the basketball. You don't have to
yeah.
be able to dribble. If you can shoot the basketball and you can shoot the three-point shot, you can make a living in the NBA today.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's that is so true. And we continue our conversation with Donald Duck Williams. And Duck, what was it like playing in the NBA? We talked about some of your teammates, but talk about on a night-to-night, game-to-game basis the people you had to face. Unlike college, where, you know, Notre Dame played a competitive schedule, but it was nothing like the NBA. There were no nights off. None.
Definitely, there were no nights off. But I think Notre Dame prepared me, you know, to be able to play in the NBA because you played against top quality competition every night, playing that college schedule. But even doing that, when you get to the NBA, you know, guys are a lot bigger, a lot stronger. You know, you're having a hand check within the play at that time,
mm-hmm,
and you're playing in college, you might play two games a week, in the NBA, you might play four, and you might have back-to-back. And every night, you're playing against a pro.
That's right.
So it wasn't easy because, you know, you might take a – you can't take a night off, really, in the NBA because the worst team in the NBA, still, by them being the worst team, but that guy that you're playing against, he's a pro. He might not have a better team than you, but you can't go out there and not be prepared because you get embarrassed.
No, you definitely can't. And during that era, I mean, you were playing with it was an era where you had the established players, and then you had the up-and-coming superstars like a Magic, like a Bird. They were just coming into the league. They were young, but they were good right away, immediately. But you still had the Kareems and people in the league. Yeah.
I'll tell you a story.
Sure.
My rookie season, we were playing the San Antonio Spurs. And, you know, normally Pistol Pete and I was in the backcourt together. And a lot of times I would be the ones guarding the shooting guard at times. And I remember a game when we played the Spurs, and I was on George Gervin.
Wow.
And I'm a rookie. Gervin is 6'8".
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And you're 6'3", right?
And there were times when we would play the Denver Nuggets, and I would be on David Thompson.
Oh, boy.
He was in the backcourt at the time. So, you know, my thing was basically you're not stopping those guys. My thing is basically, you know, you're trying to harass them and hope they miss.
Yeah.
Because they even tell them basketball players. You know, I always say in the NBA, you're not really stopping those. If you got a hell of a great offense player, you're not stopping them.
No.
You know, you're gonna try to harass them and hope you miss. But guys are so talented, you know.
I tell the young basketball followers and fans, and I love Michael Jordan. He's the GOAT. But I always tell them, before Michael Jordan, it was David Thompson. Can you tell our listeners how great of a player David Thompson was? The guy could jump, he could run, and he could shoot. He was just, as you stated, unstoppable.
Yeah, Dave was just a phenomenal basketball player, man. You know, I like to say a lot of people see Michael Jordan. A lot of people see the LeBron James, but they didn't see the David Thompson, the Dr. J's back in the day. You know, David was just a hell of a basketball. To this day, I always think about the games at the North Carolina State when there was no dunking, but you knew
the
alley was coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you thought of David Thompson, you knew that alley was coming sooner or later. You know, he just was a hell of a phenomenal basketball player.
Mm-hmm. Talk about how, and again, I had Lloyd Walton on from Marquette a couple of days ago.
Lord.
Yep, my man, good guy. And, of course, Lloyd played in the league, and now he's a senior career counselor. But talk about some of the off-the-court things that you would give advice to young and up-and-coming or aspiring NBA players, because on the court pretty much take care of itself. But it's off the court where I think the major decisions are made.
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, off the court, just be, you know, be a good person. You know, a lot of guys, you know, on the court, the hell of basketball players, and once they go out in the public, you know, They're doing crazy things, you know, always selling it, you know, as a public figure, and especially nowadays as an NBA player, you're watched all the time.
Yeah.
Because so many people, you know, kids look up to you. So, you know, you might not say you're a role model, but in essence, you are a role model because to those kids, you're a big deal. And, you know, if you're doing things the right way, could go a long way for some kid if they're watching you and you being a model citizen in today's society. You know, that could go a long way in paving a way for another a young kid who admires you or inspires you to be a good person or down the line. Because, you know, you never know, you know, what your impact could be on a kid today who's idolizing you in one way or another.
What are your thoughts on, and of course, sport is a microcosm of society, and with all of the craziness that we're facing as we speak, Duck, in terms of racial inequality, police brutality, Kaepernick taking a stand and making a point by kneeling, what is your perspective on professional athletes who have a platform? Do you look at it as an obligation to speak out, or everything is not for everyone?
Well, you know, you can say everything is not for everyone, but I just think as an athlete, you have a platform that, you know, players before you have paved the way. Yeah, I just think it's just an obligation to go out here and be heard, and you're in a position to help make a change. So if you're in that position to help make a change, why not?
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on players? And I had this conversation with Dr. Lloyd Walton. Duck Williams, what are your thoughts on players who have the ability to go straight from high school to the NBA? One of the guys who came under you was your teammate, JoJo Hunter. 2 years after you graduated, 1976, came very close to being one of the first guards to come from high school to the NBA. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts is if the guy has the ability and he's ready, then why not? A lot of guys that are not ready, you know, they just go to the NBA, and then they end up either out of the league or into the G League. You're thankful that they have the G League now. But, you know, if you're ready physically and mentally, it's going to be tough because the fact that, you know, most of those guys, you're 18 or 17 years old and you're running with grown men, it's going to be a big transition. But at the same time, if you're physically and have the skills to play the game, I don't see why not. You know, some players are physically ready and go on to be great players. You look at the LeBron James, you know, the Kevin Garnett, those players, you know. It could be done.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
Say, I don't want to being if a guy is able to provide for his family, you know, he has the skill set and he's ready, then why not?
I would concur. We've got about 8 or 9 minutes left. I have a couple more questions. Having said that, then what are your thoughts now? There's been a lot of talk on in the future having top flight collegiate athletes being compensated financially. For example, you got the scholarship. You are able to get a degree in education and also go to the NBA. But during the time you and Adrian and Lambeer and Jackson and all the people that we named were at Notre Dame on television, you made a lot of money for that university. What are your thoughts on players being able to get some type of financial compensation?
You know, I'm all in favor of the players being compensated. You know, people always say, well, you got a scholarship to go to school, but you have to look at, yeah, I got a scholarship to go to play, but there's a lot of things in schools that players don't have.
That's right.
You know, a lot of these players come from backgrounds where, you know, they don't have the funds or whatever for, you know,
that's right,
to be able to go out to eat or, mm-hmm, you know, to buy, you know, some other needs they might have, clothes or whatever. But, you know, like you say, the schools is benefiting so much from these athletes. You know, they even using their names to promote, you know, sell jerseys and so far.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see why these players shouldn't be compensated.
Yeah, I agree. If nothing else, then a Duck Williams during the off season at Notre Dame can go down to the local sporting goods shop in South Bend and sign jerseys and sign autographs and get paid for that. I mean, something like that, because, yes, you are getting a scholarship. However, it's not 1940 and 1950 where top-flight NCAA athletics are of amateur status. It's not amateur status when you have head coaches making 2, 3, 4, 5, and in football, some cases $10, $15 million a year. That doesn't sound too much like an amateur to me, Doug.
No, not at all. I'm all behind the athlete getting some kind of stipends for, you know,
mm-hmm, yeah,
being at Hill School. Those colleges are making millions on the backs of a lot of those athletes, and I don't see why they should be compensated.
What are your thoughts? Final question. What are your thoughts on the game today? Before the show, we were talking, and my producer Rick Hampton of the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com, he asked a question: if Duck Williams were playing in today's game, the way the game is called, how would you fare? And I said, not speaking for you, as great a player as you were then, you'd be even better now.
Yeah, well, I think that the floors are opened up more nowadays. Players have evolved to the point where, like you say, you know, everybody's shooting. You know, shooting the three-pointers, the big guys are out now shooting the three-pointers. So, you know, being a guard, you're able to, I would think, be able to get into the lane more, and there's less resistance, because back in the 70s, when you went to the cup, you know, there were seven-footers or the big guys, they were close to the basket all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, you know, the game has evolved to a point where, you know, your seven-footers are out at the three-point line.
That's right.
All time. So that guy got to come out and guard that other seven-footer. So if you're penetrating and there's no line of defense in the back, you know, you're not worried about that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or Moses Malone back in the back, Robert Parrish blocking your shot or whatever. You know, it just makes the game a lot easier, I think, for the guards to be able to penetrate because the floor is so spread nowadays.
Yeah, yeah. Is there a player or are there players that you watch the game today and say, well, that guy reminds me a little bit of me when I played?
Well,
I see a little Steph Curry.
I would think a guy like Steph Curry, but you know, to me, Steph Curry as far as you know, the 3-point shot, he took it to another level.
Yeah.
He took it to another level. But I think, you know, body wise and body build and able to, you know, get to the basket, you know, yeah, I could say that. But, you know, as far as, you know, shooting the 3-point shot, you know, that was something that, you know, he just took to a whole nother level.
Yeah, I think he's going to revolutionize the game because I can foresee in the future the possibility of a 4-point shot. Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, you think about the game today and you look at the kids today, when you go out and watch kids play, what are they doing? They're all shooting 3-pointers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, first thing they do is take a 3-pointer, you know.
Yeah.
And when we was coming up, if you pulled up and took a shot at the range that these guys are taking today, like I say, even you gonna be on the bench, you better make it because for one thing, first thing you hear, that's a bad shot.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't hear that today like that.
No, no.
Guys on a 2-on-1, and you thinking you're getting a layup, and that guy's pulling up and shooting a 30-footer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I got to tell you, Duck, man, I want to thank you. This has been just outstanding. I always had great respect and admiration for you. I remember real quick as a young coach, I'm just 22 years old. You guys are 17, 18. I'm coaching you in the summer, and my lineup is David Rivas, Duck Williams, Larry Hearn, Keith Hearn, Larry Long, and JoJo Hunter. You know, coming off the bench, and I'm saying, man, coaching can't be this easy, can it? But you guys were always respectful, and I appreciate that. And, man, I appreciate you coming here in the Coach's Corner. You were awesome. You still got it, my man.
Man, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me, Butch.
All right. And, folks, that was the legendary D.C.'s own Donald Duck Williams. Well, next up, next week in the Coach's Corner, we will have Adrian Branch. That's right, Maryland's own NBA Lakers and ESPN Adrian Branch is next up in the Coach's Corner. Hope you enjoyed today's show, and I want to thank our sponsors, as always, Hortons Funeral Service for over 80 years, the very best in the D.C. area. They're located at 600 Kennedy Street Northwest, 202-829-9000, 202-829-9000. As for Randolph Horton, a.k.a. Reds Bowman. And let's talk to Dr. Edward T. Buford if you're in need of any dental care, 202-667-8818. Again, 202-667-8818. And as always, I want to thank the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com, making the show possible, and, of course, my main man, my producer, Rick Hampton Sr. So, folks, hope you enjoyed this afternoon's show. As I said, coming up next, Adrian Branch and the Coach's Corner. Until then, make the decision, because life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid. We'll see you next.
You'll listen to a 30-second demo. Go premium to download the entire file.